Georgia's DBHDD is urging people to ask a pharmacist about getting naloxone for their first aid kits at home or work. No prescription is needed. Naloxone can rapidly reverse an opioid overdose and restore breathing. Opioidresponse.info.
Welcome to another edition of Political Rewind. Wow, can you believe it? It's the holiday season. I hope you all had a great Thanksgiving weekend. Now we move fully into the Hanukkah and Christmas season. Kwanzaa's coming up down the road. I feel like we should, I know you're all used to our theme music, but I feel like this month maybe we should open the show with like some Mel Torme or Gene Autry singing Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. Anyhow, happy, happy holidays to all of you out there. And again, I hope that this past weekend was restful, peaceful, and that you had a wonderful, healthy Thanksgiving holiday. The news doesn't stop, though. And in fact, this is a big, big week. Congress is back in session. They face a potential government shutdown at the end of the week if they can't resolve budgetary issues they're facing. On Wednesday, the Supreme Court takes up the Mississippi abortion case, the 15-week ban on abortion. And that, though, everybody is waiting to see what the court may do about that. And of course, we're continuing to cover the fallout from redistricting in Georgia, as well as the aftermath of the guilty verdicts in the case of the murder of Ahmaud Arbery. So a lot to talk about as the holidays pick up here. To do that today, we have my Monday partner on the show, Jim Galloway. You know Jim. He, for many years, was the political voice of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, columnist and reporter on politics, and is sort of semi-retired. Jim, how are you?
I'm doing great. I'm doing great. And if I could, I'd like to cast my vote for Mel Torme. I think he's very, very underestimated.
Oh, all right. Thank you very much for that. We'll see what we can do. We also have Raisa Habersham with us today. She's an investigative reporter for the Savannah Morning News. And we're especially glad to have you here today, Raisa, when we start talking a little bit about what's happening in the aftermath of the trial down there and what's going to happen next down in Brunswick and Glynn County. But in the meantime, thank you for being here, Raisa.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Audrey Haynes is back with us, professor of political science at the University of Georgia, and also, of course, the director of the Applied Politics program there, where she essentially mentors young people who want to have careers in politics. A very successful program. Happy holidays, Audrey.
Thank you very much. And may I share one thing I'm grateful for, Bill?
Yeah.
And that is this show and its audience, especially its Facebook Live audience, because I tell you what, I go back and I read their discussions, and very often I learn something new that I didn't know. What a great group of people interacting.
I'm glad you said that. The Facebook, I mean, we have a lot of listeners who we're obviously grateful for, but you're right, that Facebook Live group, they're really a fascinating group, and we're so happy that they continue to want to pay so much attention to the show and to comment on it every single day. So thanks for saying that. We also are welcoming back Heather Farley, who is the chairman of the Department of Criminal Justice, Public Policy, and Management at the College of Coastal Georgia down there in Brunswick. Heather, it's great to have you back with us. Hope you had a good holiday.
I did, and thank you so much for having me back today.
Absolutely. All right, let's talk briefly. Unfortunately, there's not a lot we can say at this point about the Omicron variant of the virus, but we do know that public health officials are starting to study it. They're very concerned about it, Jim. They think it may, in fact, it's possible that this particular composition of virus could bypass the protections that the vaccines have given to all of us. And Jim, I think it's worth putting it in the context of where we stand in Georgia right now. So with that in mind, I was looking up figures for vaccine rates in Georgia, Jim. We still have only about half the people, 49%+ of Georgians of all ages who have been vaccinated. And 59% have had one dose. The number is much higher for people 65 and older, where 81% are fully vaccinated. But the other issue here, Jim, is that there's a slight uptick in cases. There's an 8% increase over the last 14 days. And maybe more disturbing, Jim, is tests have gone way down in Georgia. They're down 25% over a two-week period. So, Jim, the question is, if this variant is as potentially troubling as some think, is Georgia really ready for it?
Oh, and I'm sure the answer is no. Look, it's disappointing, but I think those are the facts on the ground. And if you take a look at these vaccine rates, you know they're in rural Georgia they're astoundingly low, and you know the rural healthcare system. You're just looking at a group of hospitals that are already under fire, with including their medical personnel that aren't going that may not get any respite during this winter. Biden slapped a ban on travel from I think maybe six South African countries on just after Thanksgiving. That's really just buying time. Everybody assumes that the Omicron variant is already here. We just haven't picked it up. You talked about a decline in testing. That may be a seasonal thing. It may be just the fact that nobody's going to work. Everybody had kind of took a few weeks off for the holidays. Now the question comes is what happened during those holidays. Those family gatherings, did it spread? And that'll take us maybe two or three weeks to find out.
Yeah, that's right. So Audrey, just to amplify what Jim said, Elbert County, White County, Lumpkin County, Turner County, Bartow County, all of those counties and others have increases in the number of cases over the last 14 days, as much as 356% higher. Now, those are low population counties, so one case counts for a lot. Nevertheless, as Jim points out, it's in places like in rural Georgia, particularly, Audrey, where protections are wanting.
Yes, and, you know, it's a real concern because it feels like, according to most of the information, that we're moving potentially into another wave, and, you know, I was listening to Dr. Fauci this weekend talking about what's going on and how, you know, there's still things we don't know. I mean, what is the efficiency of the boosters? I mean, not the boosters. I just had my booster, but the vaccinations. We're going into a period where you have a lot of unvaccinated people. You have people whose vaccinations are now waning. You're moving into a season where people are indoors. So the expectation is that we'll see a rise in cases and what the nature of it will be, and will there be a new variation? But what we all know is this has moved from pandemic to endemic, and it's continuing to do so. We've lost the opportunity to deal with it effectively initially, and it's going to continue to be with us. So the end result is everyone who's involved and every political level needs to get together and think about their messaging. You know, if we really are going to move on and open up the economy and make sure that our hospitals are overwhelmed, we really need to get on the same page and work with the data and do so in a more effective manner. At this point, if you are saying things about vaccinations that are not true and pushing a message that, you know, is bordering on conspiracy theory, you are hurting not only, you know, our state, but the country as a whole.
Raisa?
Sure. I just wanted to add to that I think what concerns me is going into the top of next year where we had discussions. I mean, it would be almost 2 years ago when we had conversations about coronavirus. And we were thinking, oh, that's not going to happen here in the States. And we were very dismissive of it. And it feels as if we're entering another phase of that. And just the anti-vaccination language is only going to further compound it. I think for me also, my husband, he's a middle school math teacher, and I get concerned about whether or not parents are even vaccinating their children. It was recently when children could get effectively vaccinated. So you have all these challenges that we aren't facing head on, and I wonder, will we be back at square one again March 2022?
So thank you for that. Heather, just to close out this portion of our conversation, the other thing that this new variant poses is this question about whether this is our future, not just in the immediate future, but how many variants, how long will they continue? Is this our new life, that the coronavirus is such a powerful, powerful bacterial weapon that it will continue being a problem for us for who knows how many years? Heather, are you there?
Oh, sorry. Yes. I think to Raisa's point, it's beginning to feel like a really unfortunate Groundhog Day, right? I mean, we know the results. We saw what Delta variant could do, and we know that at a state level, at a national level, and internationally, we know what we need to do. We know that we need higher vaccination rates in our state. We know that across the country, we're seeing conservative lawmakers who are pushing against the federal mandate for employers. And then internationally, we know that lower income nations are not getting the doses that they need, and they're not getting the tech transfer that they need in order to develop the vaccines. So, until we can address this at each of those levels, we're going to continue, I think, to face this same cycle, and we're going to continue to see a lot of really sad outcomes.
Jim, I want to let you finish it up. I called it bacterial. Of course, it's viral, but go ahead, finish us off.
Right. Not to be too parochial, but I think this is a guarantee that we're going to see healthcare as a big, big issue in the 2022 elections. Obviously, Democrats are going to keep pushing for Medicaid expansion. That's no secret. What I'm wondering is if Governor Brian Kemp is going to face any kind of criticism or attacks from David Perdue. That would be my first signal, really, that his primary problems are actually real. It just seems like a guaranteed issue for discussion on the Republican primary side.
Yeah. Yeah, and clearly we're going to be watching the political implications of all of this. All right, so the trial in Brunswick is finally over. Almost 2 years of this very, very dark cloud hanging over all of us in terms of what was going to happen to the men who were finally convicted of murdering Ahmaud Arbery. And no one has, I think, been in the spotlight more than the people of Brunswick and Glynn County in all of this. And I want to talk about what the next steps are in terms of that whole coastal area of our state. Raisa, you were down there. This was a big story for all of you down in Savannah and Brunswick, Glynn County. Just give us a sense of where you think things are headed down there in the aftermath of the trial. Yes, we have sentencing coming up. Yes, there's a federal hate crimes trial. But let's talk about right now.
No, I'm glad you brought that up. I think we saw some change, I think, before the trial, when you think about last election season, and they voted out former DA Jackie Johnson, who is now facing charges of violation of oath. And her role in all of this. So they now have a new DA down there, Keith Higgins. I think at this point, for some residents, they are hoping that this obviously goes to trial and that she too is convicted. But beyond that, there are some residents who also want George Barnhill and to also receive charges in this as well for his involvement in this case as well, because it wasn't just her, it was him as well, they feel. I think for long term, I think for a lot of residents, I don't think it's just a matter of just putting it behind them. I think, they want to ensure that this doesn't happen again, and there are instrumental ways in doing that. One nonprofit that kind of formed after Ahmaud Arbery's death was A Better Glynn. And they've been instrumental in doing civic work. They also led campaigns in getting Jackie Johnson ousted from office. They've also been instrumental in social justice advocacy. So I think that we're probably going to see a bit more social justice activism in Brunswick, and how to further that in Glynn County as a whole. I wrote a story earlier this year that kind of centered on Better Glynn, where they talked about the median income there was like $28,000. So there's like little upward mobility there, and just finding ways in which you can enhance that in the community so that they kind of see themselves just beyond what people view Brunswick as in the state of Georgia and honestly nationally.
Heather, we should point out that George Barnhill was the second circuit attorney, district attorney, to get this case, and he actually wrote a letter to law enforcement saying, look, I mean, I'm obviously paraphrasing, essentially saying, leave these guys alone. Leave the McMichaels alone. This is not worth pursuing. And it is interesting that we've seen very little activity around what this might mean to him. But Heather, you, one of the reasons the first time you came on the show was because you felt that we needed to do a more balanced job in talking about the fact that Glynn County and Brunswick are not defined by the McMichaels or Roddy Bryan, and you're, of course, right. Where do you think things are now? You're right down there in Brunswick.
Yeah, thanks. You know, it was interesting, the timing of these verdicts, literally on the heels of Thanksgiving, which gave everybody a chance to sort of convene and talk and talk through what this means for us. And there was a brief moment of relief, obviously. Relief just to have the camera crews leave was a big one. However, I think that was pretty short-lived. When I've been talking to my neighbors and talking to friends and family in this area, what we are seeing is that there's really two sort of things that are looming ahead of us. One are a lot more legal court cases coming up, right, from sentencing to the federal hate crime charges. So we've got all of that coming up. So we know the eye will sort of come back to Brunswick. But there's also, as Raisa was pointing out, there's also a lot of work to do on the ground. And, you know, Bobby Henderson, who is one of the founders of A Better Glynn, posted to his Facebook yesterday, and he said, you know, justice is not a one-time event. And I thought that wrapped it up just perfectly, right? It's, you know, it's great that this part of the justice system operated appropriately, but everything leading up to it was not. And so we have so much work to do on sort of the criminal justice reform. A Better Glynn is ensuring that we can get better attorneys in our area, including people like Keith Higgins. They are going to be in January having Keith Higgins here for a sort of state of the office address in which he'll be talking about things like bail reform and budget increases to attract new attorneys and diversity initiatives. We are going to be seeing a new justice center being put in the Rise Risley initiative downtown, which is bringing local ACLU and NAACP representatives to that area so that people have a point of contact there. And then we're, again, seeing sort of an equity clergy holding equity dinners and a racial healing summit. And so that clergy group continues to do a great deal as well to move us forward.
Audrey?
Well, you know, I would simply add that terrible things can sometimes lead to positive change. And that one of the key requirements, we see this happening in politics and in life, is that good people get involved and that social capital is invested and institutions are built to hold people accountable. And, you know, throughout our time period now across this country, we're looking at how institutions are very valuable. And when they have any kind of limitation, such as not being trusted or not having people who are accountable, you know, leading them, you know, you can produce terrible outcomes. So I would say that hopefully this will allow Glynn County and those observing, in fact, you know, the whole world observed this hearing, that they'll see what happens when you don't have people making equitable decisions, fair decisions,
and honorable decisions, and then, you know, having to deal with the aftermath. And it's not pleasant, but hopefully we'll see that change.
Bill, I'd like to hear from Heather on something that was really struck me on Wednesday when the verdict came down, and that is the role of firearms in public spaces, because we had the written. I mean, this came on the heels of the Rittenhouse verdict, in which you had an AR-15 inserted into a very volatile situation, and it did not make anyone more safe. In fact, it provoked it created a defense. You grab my gun, I think you're going to take it and use it on me, and I'm going to kill you. You had the same argument in Brunswick, and it didn't fly. And so I'm wondering how that's going, Heather. I'm wondering how you think that's going to affect the debate, because I think it's a really important one that we have to have.
Yeah, thanks. I think there's a narrative that's going on, and I'm hesitant to compare the two cases too closely, just because so much of the circumstances surrounding those cases were quite different. But I think what it comes down to is the way the narrative was presented. The narrative in the Rittenhouse case really made the defense made their case that there was this angry mob, and Rittenhouse was a young man kind of caught up in that melee, right? That was sort of the narrative around that case. Whereas in the Arbery trial, in the murder trial for Ahmaud Arbery, in that trial, the defense was not successful, despite their best efforts, despite them saying very clearly that he was responsible for his death. They were not successful in convincing the jury that he was not a victim. And so I think that's really where the big difference is here, is in that narrative that they were able to paint in each of these cases.
Right. Okay. Tell you what, Audrey, weigh in, and then Raisa, before we take a break. Let me get to both of you. Audrey?
Yeah. I would just add, in the Rittenhouse case, you had another gun involved, and that gun was, presented and pointed at Rittenhouse. And in Arbery, Arbery clearly had no weapon, was not posing any kind of threat to anyone. So, a different scenario, and very clear to the jury, I think, that difference. And that's why it resulted as it did.
Raisa, why don't you take us to the break with your comments?
Sure. I think one thing to consider is what is defined as citizen arrest, and how and when you can make one. You would have to have firsthand knowledge of a crime being committed on said property, and that did not happen here. I think that there has been much conversation about race in this particular trial. I think we'll see, obviously, that come up at the hate crimes trial as well. I think that the jurors seem to be very clear on the judge's instructions, and they very much apply the definitions that were given to them in this case, which is in part why we ended up seeing the verdict that we saw in the end.
So finally, before we go to the break, a couple things. First of all, it was Margaret Coker, editor-in-chief of The Current, who first on this show let us know about a better Glynn, which is an organization. It's an African-American based organization, and it feels to me like it is such a positive development for the county, for the city. If there's Audrey said, if there are good things that come out of terrible tragedies, and Better Glynn seems to be one of them, and it's very exciting. It'll be interesting to watch how they develop down there. So let's just leave it there. There's going to be a lot more to talk about because of the hate crimes trial coming up, because of the sentencing. And, of course, we'll keep our eye on that. For right now, let's take our first break of the show and come back and talk politics with our panel. Welcome back to the show. I'll reintroduce the panel in just a moment, but given that it was a long holiday weekend, I know that so many of you don't ever, ever miss an episode of Political Rewind. But maybe a lot of you weren't listening on Friday when you were off with family and friends. And I would really recommend that if you want to listen to a deeper dive into the outcome of the Arbery case, you might want to listen to our Friday show. Andre Gillespie, Patricia Murphy, Margaret Coker really went into great depth on their sense of what happened down there. It's available on our podcast. It's on our website. And it really is, I think, worthwhile. Heather Farley, who is with College of Coastal Georgia, Audrey Haynes, professor of political science, University of Georgia, Raisa Habersham, Savannah Morning News, and of course, Jim Galloway with us today. Heather, one quick comment that you thought was pertinent. You point out that this was a majority female jury, and yes, there was only one African-American, but you think maybe the gender composition of the jury had an impact.
Yeah, I can't help but wonder if the fact that, you know, while, yes, 11 of the jurors were white, 9 of them were women. And so, you know, you can't help but wonder how that might have influenced the outcome. And again, you know, I think that influenced the way the narrative may have been heard as well. So I found that interesting. And if I could point out just one more thing as well, you know, I know that the runoff election in Atlanta, the mayoral runoff is coming up, but we also have a mayoral runoff here in Brunswick coming up tomorrow as well. And so that's going to, when we're talking about a better Glenn, they have been really instrumental in that mayoral race and in, again, leadership development in our area. So it will be really, really interesting and exciting to see what the outcome of that is and whether or not they are able to get those voters out because they spend so much time trying to just get the vote out for leaders who will be invested in social equity.
Yeah, right. So that's one of the important things about Better Glenn is they've worked on voter registration. They've been very active in as Heather points out, trying to get people to understand the only way you're going to change things is to get out and cast your ballot. So I'm glad that Heather mentioned that. And I guess, Raisa, we'll all want to watch what happens in that mayor's race tomorrow. Yeah?
Yes, and I'm glad you brought that up, Heather, just because I know one of the candidates has been endorsed by members of the Arbery family already heading into the runoff. So it is going to be curious how the verdict in and of itself and the results of the trial do play into tomorrow's election. I know that this is something that the trial has kind of been something that's on and off been at the center of the mayoral race. I know there are other issues in Brunswick as well beyond the trial, but it is curious just to see how this will play out tomorrow.
All right. Well, thank you for putting that on the radar. So we'll keep track of it. And we're, of course, going to be following the Atlanta mayor's runoff election, and we'll add Brunswick to our list. So thank you for that. Jim Galloway, let's move on. A story that came up last week that, because it was a holiday week, didn't get maybe as much attention as it otherwise would have, has to do with what some people up there in your neck of the woods, in Cobb County particularly, are calling the sneak attack, in which the legislature, we knew about some of the things they were going to do in drawing new lines. I mean, clearly there was a lot of attention paid to the fact that Lucy McBath's 6th District is no longer safe for her to run in, so she's going to run against Carolyn Bordeaux in the 7th. We knew about that one. We also knew, in terms of the congressional map, that Sanford Bishop, because of the population sparsity now down there, was going to get a district that was drawn with more Republicans. But he's presumably likely to still be okay in that district. But Jim, what wasn't anticipated was the changes in Marjorie Taylor Greene's 14th district, which suddenly comes all the way down into Cobb County. By the way, Galloway, are you now a constituent of Marjorie Taylor Greene if this map gets approval?
Actually, no. I'm in the kind of the northwest quadrant of Cobb.
Okay.
And she was wrapped into the southwest quadrant of Austell and Powder Springs, and if it was unexpected, it wasn't really that much of a surprise. I mean, redistricting, you know, if you're the party in power, what you're trying to do is pack and crack. You're trying to pack all your opposing voters into as small a number of districts as possible, and those you cannot pack, you disperse them into stronger Republican strongholds so that their impact is diluted. Of course, Marjorie Taylor Greene is not happy about this. She likes having an 80% Donald Trump district, and woe is her. She's now got maybe a 70-65% district. What's interesting is that, she had probably, I believe, Audrey, you correct me if I'm wrong, she had what I think is probably the whitest congressional district in all of Georgia. And she moves, and she now has a piece of this thriving African American section. This is the portion of Cobb that really drove my county into blue territory. And so the question now comes to me is, all right, now that you've placed those people in her district, have you neutralized them? Or have you just made them mad? And are you going to be driving voters, more Democratic voters, to the polls, which in turn would actually hurt Barry Loudermilk in the adjacent district, who you're trying to help?
Yeah. So great. A lot to unpack in what you said, Jim. Audrey, let me just set up a little more here. Marjorie Taylor Greene's comment when she saw the new lines was she called it, quote, a fool's errand that was led by power-obsessed state legislators. But here's what I wonder. As Jim points out, she is now representing one of the most diverse parts of Cobb County. In fact, maybe the most diverse part of Cobb County. In what world do those constituents get fair representation from Marjorie Taylor Greene? And to me, that's the issue. The issue isn't the politician side. It's the constituent side. It's still a Republican district, I think, overwhelmingly, as Jim pointed out. There's no reason to think she won't win re-election. It's this constituents now who have lost the voice of a member of Congress. They were represented by David Scott, for goodness sake.
Yes. And, you know, in the 80s, there were a number of court cases that came up where people were saying, you know, we've lost our representation because of majority-minority districts and all kinds of history in that area. But what I would tell you is that happens. It's happened in many states. It happens to both Democrats and Republicans in the nasty process that sometimes happens in redistricting. It's really tough. Both parties do it. And this is one of the reasons that independent commissions are sometimes thought to be a much better tool in order to produce these districts, because there are less machinations, and often the outcome is one where you have better levels of representation. But let me just add that perhaps there is some value in that if more establishment Republicans and Democrats from that area can get together during the primary, they can organize themselves and perhaps vote for a candidate that is closer to both of their interests, that won't be quite so far off on the wings of the party, which, you know, might be in another planet when it comes to Marjorie Taylor Greene. I'm not sure. Sometimes that happens. I will say that I vote in primaries sometimes for opposition parties, so I get the candidate that is closer to me, and we might see some of that happen.
Heather?
Yeah, I think given some of the anti-Semitic and very racist things that Marjorie Taylor Greene has said in the past, I think doing the district lines this way can only fire up those Democrats in Southwest Cobb. And when Democrats are fired up and they show up to the polls, Democrats do well in Georgia. So this, I can see where this would really upset Marjorie Taylor Greene, not only because it may dilute her vote very slightly, as Jim pointed out, but more so because I think statewide, this could really ignite a fire under the Democrats.
Ray, you said, I want to go back to this question. I understand that Democrats could be motivated as a result of all this. But we also have said, all of us, it's still a Republican district. To what extent do we have a right to be represented by people who will, in fact, take our views into consideration when they represent us in Congress?
Ooh, that's a tough one. I think it goes back to what Heather said. I mean, can you trust that this person will view you, represent you adequately, given some of the negative things that have been said? I think we'll probably will see more mobilization from Democrats next year, because next year is a big year. It's not just redistricting at play. We'll have a gubernatorial race. And there's still chatter about who will be their candidate. So I think that we'll probably see more mobilization around voting and creative ways around that, given that we also altered our voting law here in Georgia.
Jim?
Yeah, Bill, you were talking about, you know, what this means for citizens in Southwest Cobb. And to me, that speaks to constituent services and whether they'll get a fair shake when they call their Marjorie Taylor Greene's office and get help with a Social Security check or a problem with veterans benefits. And you know, let's pray that they do get that service. If they don't get that service, what happens then, though, is that those voters, they drift to where they can get help, and that's where Raphael Warnock comes in. That's where John Ossoff comes in, because they become the de facto representative for that group if they don't get satisfaction from their a member of Congress.
All right. Thank you for that perspective on that. We're going to watch. We already know that there are going to be a number of lawsuits filed because of a lot of the district changes, which we'll talk about not just at congressional level, but in the state house as well. Mark Elias, who's been a prominent Democratic attorney, represented Hillary Clinton in the presidential campaign four years ago. She said. He said that he thinks Georgia is going to be number one in the country in terms of challenges to district line. So we'll watch how that unfolds. But, Jim, Natalie Mendenhall just sent me a big breaking news story that I want to share with you first. You mentioned David Perdue, Brian Kemp, whether there's going to be a primary contest there. The Georgia Chamber of Commerce just announced its endorsement of Brian Kemp. Jim, that's a big deal. It's something that a David Perdue can't afford not to look at.
No, absolutely, and it goes. This goes back to the 2018 race for governor, and that was pre-pandemic, so I was there. But you had this. I mean, in August, the Georgia Chamber has this huge gathering in Macon every year. And they direct it toward relationships with state and federal government. The feature there were the two nominees for governor that year, Stacey Abrams and Brian Kemp. Typically, Democrats get short shrifted at a gathering at this, but the Georgia Chamber felt kind of the shift in the winds. And they gave a very even-handed presentation of both candidates, and that greatly offended the Kemp camp, and which means the last couple legislative sessions have been pretty hard for the Georgia Chamber, so this is kind of an interesting move on their part.
All right, let's do this. Let's get our final break of the show out of the way and come back with more on today's Political Rewind. Let's see if we can do a few quick fire items before we run out of time today. Audrey Haynes, there are times when people, you talked about our Facebook Live group a little while ago. Sometimes when we talk about Marjorie Taylor Greene, we get pushback. People say, don't give her the attention. That's all she's looking for. I get that. But the reality of it is, Audrey, that, like it or not, she and her compatriots in that far right wing of the Republican Party in the U.S. House are having a bigger and bigger impact. And it goes on as people like the leadership of the Republicans in the House don't push back on anything they say. Well, Audrey, we now know that Marjorie Taylor Greene is perhaps going to start leading a charge that would stop Kevin McCarthy from becoming Speaker of the House if Republicans do take control again. So, you know, the fact that he has been cautious about criticizing her, she doesn't think he's done enough to protect people like her, Audrey.
Yeah, that was an amazing irony when I heard about that, that someone who has, you know, walked on eggshells not to upset Trump and not to upset people like Marjorie Taylor Greene or, you know, castigate her the way that she probably deserved to be castigated for much of her actions in Congress, is now in a very Trumpian way, she has called into question his ability to lead the party and is doing just that, criticizing him and saying that he's not good enough. And again, full of irony, I don't think it will have much of an impact, honestly. I don't see that her group, the Jim Jordans and the Matt Gaetz, are really resonating very well right now. I think a lot of what's going on in Congress is moving past them. But still, the very fact that she would do it, you know, it does signal something. Perhaps she isn't getting as much attention as she has in the past and is trying to get that attention, and she did get a story. But again, we shall see.
We'll see whether there's any momentum behind something like that. Raisa, the other thing that Marjorie Taylor Greene got some attention for this past week was that this won't go anywhere. Nevertheless, she introduced a bill to honor Kyle Rittenhouse with a congressional gold medal, Raisa, because he was a hero in Kenosha, killing two people, wounding a third. Raisa?
No, I don't think that will go over too well. But it does speak to, I'm not going to say the tone deafness, but her persistence in sticking by her views. And it took me back in the mindset of January 6th, for some reason, just this idea of upholding a particular stance or particular perspective that is indeed harmful to others and just being ignorant of that and just kind of casting that aside. But I also think this, again, speaks to her looking for attention in any means necessary.
Heather, okay. Check me on this. Is it a mistake for us to spend too much time talking about Marjorie Taylor Greene? I am open to criticism.
Well, you know, I think that you can't ignore her either, right? And on the other side of the aisle, we see that when people stand in the way, like Kyrsten Sinema, for instance, on the Democratic side, we know they can have an impact. So I think you do have to keep these things in check and continue to watch them and call them out and make them accountable for misinformation and so on and so forth. No, I don't think you're giving it too much lip service. I think it's necessary to keep tabs on people who may have the potential to be harmful.
So, Jim, real quick, I don't want to go too much more on this, but, you know, these things have a way of spiraling out of control. So none of us believed when the first abortion bill was introduced in the Georgia legislature that it was going to be as extreme a ban as it turned out to be. Everybody said, no, the Speaker of the House, the governor, they don't want to go too far. And we end up because momentum builds in the conservative circles in this state, things happen that are unexpected. And my sense is that's a possibility with Marjorie Taylor Greene and the people who are surrounding her.
Right. What's interesting, the other part of this story, Bill, is, and I'll try to be quick, is that Kevin McCarthy did call Marjorie Taylor Greene, and they had a nice conversation. And after that conversation, she put out another tweet saying, "We talked, I liked his plans." In her plans, what she wants, you know, anyone who cooperates with a Democratic effort like the infrastructure bill, 13 House Republicans, she wants them out of the caucus or punished or stripped of committees.
All right, let's move on. Jim, we don't have a lot of time to talk about it, but of course, the final day of voting is tomorrow in the Atlanta mayor's runoff. There's been early voting by now. And it comes down to two issues here. Which of the two candidates seems to have the better plan for public safety? And I think also there are people who are looking at which of, and maybe fewer people, but for us as analysts, I think it's important, which of the two is more likely to have impact in terms of the Stop Buckhead City movement, Jim?
Right, and I think the matter there is trust there. Who will be perceived as the best defender of the city of Atlanta? I think it's very interesting in the way that the city's African American establishment and much of the sectors in Midtown and such have really lined up behind Andre Dickens, and I think that's very telling.
Yeah, Audrey, I do think that's interesting. In the final days, in the closing days of the race, it is Andre Dickens, not Felicia Moore, despite her many years of service in the city council. It is Andre Dickens who's really picked up momentum, at least in terms of endorsements.
Well, and you know what? Part of it is he's been doing a lot of work. He has been out there and he has been, as they say in politics, pressing the flesh, meeting with people. And part of it too is you've got younger, more progressive voters in Atlanta out there, and he may have more of an appeal. After I listened to the debate between both of those candidates in particular, there is a bit of not older but more establishment, more traditional personality that goes along with Moore, and Dickens captures more of this more current progressive he just captures that sort of wave, so that is probably one of the reasons that's going on at this moment, where he's got that bit of momentum.
Right, Reyesa, on our WebEx where we see each other, I saw you nodding vigorously as Audrey was saying those things. Weigh in.
Yes, I was going to say he's less establishment. I think that having covered City Hall before and just kind of looking at the changes that he's kind of brought to the city, I mean, he was instrumental in bringing a Department of Transportation to the city, something we desperately needed but had never had. And so I'm more curious to see what he could bring to the table. And I imagine that other people in my peer group, well, I'm more curious to see what he can bring to the peer group than, say, Felicia Moore, who does have the experience, but I think has not connected with that younger base.
Reyesa Habersham gets the last word in today's Political Rewind. Reyesa, thank you so much for being here. Heather, great to have you back. Audrey Haynes, a veteran of this show for many years, you know we always love having you with us. And Jim Galloway, thank you for being part of Political Rewind today. We have a couple minutes left, and I told our team that I wanted to take a moment of personal privilege as we close the show today. I think those of you who listen to the show regularly know that theater is a very important part of my life. My wife is a playwright. Our daughter works in theater in New York. The three of us were very, very saddened, like so many of you out there, when we learned the news that Stephen Sondheim died on Friday at 91 unexpectedly. If you're not a great fan of Broadway, of musicals, you may not know that this was truly the giant, the most important force in theater in the second half of the 20th century. And no artist has ever brought more beauty, more deeper emotion, and a more rigorous honesty to his work and to my life than Stephen Sondheim. His shows, everything from Company to A Little Night Music, to Into the Woods, to Sweeney Todd, to so many others, are extraordinary works. Not just his composition, but his lyrics as well. He was meticulous in the way that he wrote his lyrics. There's a funny story. You know, he wrote the lyrics to West Side Story, and he would tell you up until this day that he could never like the lyrics that he wrote to that show. And one of the reasons is in the famous song, There's a Place for Us. He said the way that he wrote that lyric, the emphasis in that line, there's a place for us, is on the word A, the least important word in the entire sentence. That was Sondheim. There are people who say his music wasn't hummable, but it was brilliant and beautiful and complex and compassionate. And so to close the show today, I want to play a song from an early show of his. It was a failure. It's a song that I sang to my children, Bill and Emma, when they were little, every night. It means a lot to me personally, and I want to share it with you today as we leave and say thank you for such a wonderful, wonderful body of work, Stephen Sondheim. It's a song called Anyone Can Whistle from a 1964 Broadway show sung here by Lee Remick. See you all tomorrow. Take care. Stay healthy.
Anyone can whistle, that's what they say, easy. Anyone can whistle any old day, easy. It's all so simple. Relax, let go, let fly. So someone tell me why.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.